morning, Oregon, and thank you once again for loading me down and queuing me up. I'm Finn J.D. John, bringing you another daily episode of the Offbeat Oregon History Podcast, which every weekday brings you another story from the archives of the Offbeat Oregon History syndicated newspaper column. To find the full details of that at offbeatoregon.com, our anchor page, do check that out, please. But first, sit back and relax. Let me tell you the story of the scariest, gnarliest, ugliest faith cult that I know of in Oregon history. Preacher Edmund Creffield's Bride of Christ Church, also known as the Holy Rollers. This organization broke up families, sanctioned adultery, and inspired deadly violence in the early 20th century. Ironically, its practitioners' goal was perfect holiness and godliness. Did not work out that way. This is part one of two articles about the Holy Rollers in Corvallis. I'll have the next part of this will be next Monday, but for now, I'll get started on the first. Here we go. In the years after one-time Corvallis resident F. Edmund Creffield died, his legend got weirder and weirder. But then it was pretty weird to start with, and it was not the kind of story that mellows with age. By 1951, 45 years later, it had reached something of a high-water mark in a story and article in Startling Detective magazine headlined, "Nemesis of the Nudist High Priest." Well, pulp fans will instantly recognize the startling part of Startling Detective as the telltale hallmark of a pulp magazine. And indeed, for the true fan of wild and shameless sensationalism, this article does not disappoint. This article paints a fantastic picture of a lascivious con artist posing as a holy man, sharking up a flock of the town's comelier ladies and preying upon their weak feminine minds with a diabolical message. Clothing is vanity. Let's all get naked and roll on the floor. Well, it gets worse. The article goes on to relate how the prophet Creffield, scare quotes around prophet there, calling himself the new Joshua, convinced the lucky ladies that one of them was to be the new Mary, mother of the new Jesus, and that he himself would be standing in for the good Lord and making the necessary carnal arrangements so that that could happen. So, this thoroughly untrustworthy account continues, Creffield started a selection process in which the brainwashed beauties were, if you will, auditioned, naked, of course, behind closed doors in a process that sometimes involved whips. No, really. Well, the whips were a nifty addition to a yarn that was first set to paper by legendary Oregon writer Stuart Holbrook in 1941. Holbrook, delightful though he is to read, simply cannot be trusted on stories that touch on religion, and if I were compelled to defend that statement in court, his version of this story would be Exhibit A. In it, he's remarkably snarky and eager to believe and pass on the most lascivious and scandalous of the many rumors that flowed out from this case. Holbrook's article was clearly the primary source for the Startling Detective story. The real story of Creffield's cult, which came to be known as the Bride of Christ Church, is quite a bit more believable and much more nuanced. It certainly relies a lot less on the once prominent myth that women are naturally gullible and stupid and, absent the steadying hand of a man, easily led into promiscuity and sin, a mythological construct which the Startling Detective magazine writer seems to sort of revel in a little bit. In other words, if you're female, you'll find the real story a lot less insulting. But the real story is, if anything, even more disturbing than the augmented ones, because it lacks the comforting feel of stereotype and fantasy. It's a story of good-hearted, well-meaning people who, in the name of goodness and holiness, opened the door to evil and chaos. The story, if you will, of how the saintly can become the tools of Satan. Our story starts in 1903, when Creffield, a 30-ish native of Germany burning with religious fervor, left the Salvation Army because he thought they weren't holy enough. I will now pause for a moment so that those of you who are familiar with the history of the Salvation Army can pick your jaws back up off the floor. Creffield settled in Corvallis and started preaching, building a flock of super strict followers. Creffield's followers were like the most hardcore Pentecostalists you can imagine. At the same time, their extreme simplicity made the plain-dressing Quakers look like French royal courtiers by comparison. They prayed face down on the floor, occasionally rolling over in a sort of power grovel, hence the pejorative term holy roller, which may actually have started with this very group. Their church services were loud, sincere, and disruptive to the neighbors, full of wailing and gnashing of teeth, and lasted for hours on end, dragging on into the night until the small hours of the morning. Corvallis residents at first got along reasonably well with their new freakishly hyper-holy neighbors. But things started going sour within just a few months. The main reason was Creffield taught that believers were to have nothing to do with unbelievers. That meant that if a man or woman joined the group, he or she was to cut off contact with any family members who had not also joined. Wives, husbands, children, parents, whatever. Okay, well, here's how that worked out in Corvallis. A married couple would join the church. After a while, the man would get tired of the extreme self-denial and subjugation to the will of Creffield and drift off. His wife would then, at some point, identify him as a non-believer and cut him off. If there were children involved, they would either stay in the church and be cut off from their father or leave the church and be abandoned by their mother. It was not a healthy dynamic, no matter how it played out. Soon, Creffield had a reputation for breaking up homes and a flock consisting largely of women who actively avoided their infidel family members. It also bothered the rest of the community that Creffield's cult members were living in a communal house, men and women together. Moreover, their simple clothing consisted of a plain cloth wrapper, which the outsiders felt was inadequate to protect female modesty and, in any case, looked entirely too easy to take off. By itself, this communal living arrangement would have been bad enough. But Creffield's followers combined it with a mania for secrecy that all but invited other community members to fear the worst. Members vanished from their families' lives into a locked house with barred windows supervised only by the cult leader and his cronies. Things got worse. Following yet another pattern that would become all too familiar to the world in later decades, think David Koresh and Jim Jones, the lack of contact with the outside world and the unstinting adoration of his flock started doing things to the mind of the cult's leader. His message got increasingly unbiblical as he claimed he was receiving instructions directly from God himself. He promoted himself from the second Joshua to the second Elijah, which, if you know your Old Testament, is rather a big step up. Finally, the men of Corvallis organized a little party for Creffield. They marched him and his sidekick, Brooks, yes, there were only two men left at the time, at this point, to the edge of town, stripped the two of them naked, painted them with pine tar, covered them with feathers, and ordered them to get out of town and stay out. Creffield responded by appearing the very next day at the courthouse in Linn County, his skin bright red from scrubbing and reeking of the turpentine used to remove the tar, and marrying one of his followers, Maud, a daughter of the Hurt family of highly respected Corvallis pioneers. A few months later came the pivotal incident in our story, the incident that would doom Creffield and much of his flock. A man named Burgess Starr filed charges against Creffield for adultery, accusing Creffield of sleeping with his wife, Donna Starr. Creffield promptly went into hiding. Weeks later he was found, naked and filthy, lying in a coffin-sized hole under a follower's home in Corvallis. Hauled into court, Creffield unhesitatingly admitted guilt. It had been part of a vital, God-ordered purification ritual, he explained. This development electrified Corvallis. All over the area, people started making the same connections. They thought about all these women, refusing to speak to their husbands and fathers, praying and rolling around in somebody's house or on the sect's encampment on a secluded island in the Willamette, all under the supervision of an avowed adulterer who saw nothing wrong with having sex with someone else's wife. Could it be that Donna Starr wasn't the only one? Perhaps God was ordering Creffield to purify other women, too. Really, given the evidence, it would be hard to think otherwise. It was probably at this time that the rumors got started about Creffield's alleged plan to impregnate a selected follower on behalf of God Almighty. It's possible that this rumor was true, but I've found no solid evidence to back it up, and neither have Phillips and Gartner, who spent a lot more time looking at it in preparation for the book they wrote, than I did. This also is almost certainly the point at which cult members ostracized male family members started thinking seriously about assassination as a solution to the Creffield problem. We'll talk about how that worked out in part two of this report, which will be on the server Monday of next week. And that's it for today's episode, part one of our two-article series about the Holy Rollers of Corvallis, Oregon. If you're listening for the first time and want more information about offbeat Oregon history, you can get it all at our central website at offbeatoregon.com. The complete catalog of about 205 columns going back to 2008, plus links out to audio and text feeds on RSS and iTunes, and the Facebook page and Twitter feed. The website's also where you'll find full citations to sources for this story, which for today's episode include books by Jim Phillips and Rosemary Gardner, and magazine articles by Stuart Holbrook and Lewis Thompson. Our theme music is by the Atlas String Band, atlasstringband.com, and was written by Carmen Ficarra. This podcast is covered under a Creative Commons license. For details of that, see offbeatorgan.com/cc. Coming to Corvallis, drop me a line and let's grab a cup of coffee and talk history. I'm at finn@offbeatorgan.com. Or if you do Twitter, you can get me at offbeatorgan. Well, that's it for today. And coming up tomorrow, we're going to talk about the Hog Railroad. It's kind of ironic. The second half of the story about the Holy Rollers is going to involve the Hog Railroad. T. Edgington Hogg was the fellow who built it. It was a railroad line which ran from Corvallis out to Newport. Hogg's plan was to create, out of Newport, the major seaport of the West Coast. A rival not to Portland, but to San Francisco, which he imagined would take over from Portland. It kind of makes a certain amount of sense. It did not work out for him. And there's some reason to suspect that some of the hard-eyed, sharp-elbowed Yankee traders that ran the city of Portland took a direct intervention to make sure that it did not. I'll have that story for you after about 6 a.m. tomorrow morning, tomorrow, of course, being New Year's Day. In the meantime, go out and fill up the rest of your New Year's Eve with good stuff, and Happy New Year. Bye now.